You are listening to the sassiest podcast in the world. Born in the Nordics, democratizing B2B SaaS knowledge everywhere.
Hi, I'm Daniel.
And I'm Thomas, and we are experienced SaaS professionals that are curious about how other successful SaaS companies go to market, scale, build winning teams, and great products.
Join us on our journey as we speak to SaaS leaders trying to get hold of their secret sauce.
And today's guest is Ingrid Bunde Åkerlin, principal at Ox.
If the person does a good job, the sales cycles will be shorter and the conversion rates will be higher. Therefore, it's going to indirectly impact our CAC payback period, even if that person is not directly generating leads.
Hello there.
Hello there. Are you happy to see me again?
Always, always. I can't get enough, which is good because I have, you know, huge amounts of Daniel here in my life, and I hope that you have huge amount of happiness and expectations also. If you are coming to Sassiest next week, it's actually just 1 week left before the ultimate B2B SaaS experience here in the Nordics. Daniel, how do you feel?
You know, I love that you said, I hope you have expectations.
Yeah, you should have.
Yeah, I hope people have expectations on us. You know, you commit your time, you commit some funds, you prioritize spending time with the community for, you know, 2-3 days here. So of course you should have expectations. And you know what that brings me to? Our customer promise. So not too long ago, I spoke to Mimi Turner, who's actually going to speak at Sassiest. She is working at LinkedIn, and they have done a fantastic research on companies that have a customer promise, like a real promise that you can hold them accountable to. They outperform companies that don't have it, which made me think about our promise. And Thomas, we haven't spoken specifically about this, but I'm going to try to say something that we promise people.
Okay.
And then you say that I agree or don't agree or add to that, whatever that is. But one promise that we definitely want to put out there is that we promise you, by spending time with us at the event here, you will go home inspired and you will go home with a new set of playbooks that you can implement right away that accelerate your individual journey and the company you're representing. That is a promise we make here. And the reason why we can make this is because we promise that you will be surrounded with peers, so other CMOs, other CPOs, other CROs, whatever your discipline is, that are on a similar trajectory or a little bit ahead of you, that are willing to share their learnings with you. And of course, we promise that you will get a speaker roster here that will give you tangible and hands-on tactics that you can implement. Lots of promises there, but if we don't send you home feeling inspired with some new ideas how to accelerate, we failed.
Yeah, and another promise is that we will take care of you. You will, you know, be fed, but also, you know, have many opportunities to have fun, both in the social events and in the evening and the party and so. Yeah, that you will have a great time. So looking forward to see you next week.
Definitely, definitely. And like last final things about Sassiest here, Thomas, what's top of mind for you 1 week up to the event here? Anything you want to share with listeners here, where your focus will be at? What details you'll be working on?
For the last days here?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of, you know, we try to see that, you know, people that are planning to come, do they really have tickets? Have people registered for the things that they should? All the details, have everyone gotten into the networking app? We just try to, you know, grease the wheel, you know, put grease in the machinery. So, and also, you know, to see the details, so no one feels that, you know, okay, what happened here? I was interested in this, or I wanted to go here, and yeah. So just, you know, just those kind of things. And then also I think, you know, it's all the last minute things, you know, around the things that needs to be printed, things that needs to be delivered, all of those things that the logistics that we work a lot with now in the end.
Definitely. Definitely. All right. With that said, we have a fantastic episode ahead of us here. A topic that I think relates to many people. It's about, you know, you have product market fit. And how do you go from there into a smooth and efficient scaling exercise without hitting any plateaus or running into big bumps? And I think we're going to find out probably a bunch of good ideas here from Ingrid, right?
Yeah, we will. And you will be able to meet Ingrid as well at Sassiest. But now, let's dive into the discussion. Today, we are super happy to welcome Ingrid Bonde Åkerlind, the principal at Ox, here as a guest in the Sassiest podcast. Welcome, Ingrid.
Thanks, guys. Super excited to be here.
It's great to have you here, Ingrid. I'm always curious. I know you are a traveler of the world, or a citizen of the world, maybe I should say. Like, where in the world are you right now?
I'm actually probably in the least exciting answer, I think, to any question I'll have today, is I'm sitting in my apartment in central Stockholm. So, sorry.
just last week, when Stockholm is exciting, yeah. But just last week when we chit-chatted,
yeah.
You were in Wineland, somewhere in the middle of France. I don't know if you were enjoying wine, but you were there for some reason.
I was in Burgundy. My husband is from there, so I was spending the Easter week with my in-laws.
All right.
There. But luckily, wine is grown there, but you can enjoy it anywhere in the world.
Yeah. Exactly. So did you bring home a few bottles with you? Like, what's your go-to wine?
My go-to wine? Ooh, my French go-to wine is actually not from Burgundy. It's a Sancerre, rather. It would be my go-to French wine. Otherwise, I am very partial to a California Cabernet Sauvignon.
Okay.
Cool.
If there isn't a sort of wine drinking event yet at Sassiest, we're going to need to make one.
Yeah.
For next year. This year might be too late to plan for one, but next year.
We actually serve quite a lot of wine during the Sassiest event, but I'm going to be the first one to admit, I don't know, Thomas, maybe you know, I have no idea what wine is served. We haven't decided yet.
No, we haven't decided on the wine. We trust the venue to select the good wine for us. But now we know who to turn to when it comes to, you know, doing some wine-related activities with Sassiest as well. And also, Ingrid, we would like to know more about you here to start with. And we know that you've been spending a lot of time in the States. You helped us understand a word here, impertinent, that someone described us and what we're doing. I guess it was like a little bit rude or not so much.
Not respecting authority, a little bit rebellious, right?
Yeah.
Not respecting authority. Poking fun at things.
Yeah.
I'll take that.
Basically what you guys do.
Well, that's us.
Exactly.
Yeah. But back to you, Ingrid. What's your story?
Sure. So I am Swedish, but I grew up in Seattle in the US, hence impertinent, definitely in my vocabulary. Some Swedish words, not so much. But luckily, SaaS is a very international field. Studied as an engineer, started my career in energy policy. Then I worked in startups in operational roles on the go-to-market side for many years before I moved over to investing 4 years ago at Ox. And I'm sure we'll get a chance to dive into some of those operational learnings when we're talking today.
Why did you go to the dark side?
Why I went to the dark side? Long story. I think basically I'm a really curious person, want to try new different things. And I felt that I love startups. Love SaaS, want to stay in this field, but I love a slightly different perspective. That's the sort of simplest way of saying it from the sort of what actually happened way. I called up the investors I knew when I wanted to switch jobs. So I called up Mikhail here at Ox,
yeah.
And thought he was going to send me off to Funnel, and he decided that he wanted to keep me for himself.
Okay. And what do you enjoy with working on the investor side?
It's a huge privilege to get to talk to really interesting companies on an almost daily basis. So I get to spend, say, an hour at a time and dive into a conversation, hear an entrepreneur's really personal story of why they started their company, where that company's gotten to. It feeds my curiosity, but then hopefully we can very quickly slide into some of the sort of, I can understand very quickly where they are on their scaling journey and hopefully offer some advice. And so sort of conversation by conversation, you get an ability to share the best practices and learnings that you've gotten from companies you've worked in, companies that we've invested in, with the rest of the community. I really enjoy that exchange.
That's very cool, and we can appreciate that. And one thing I wanted to ask you as well, like you mentioned here that, you know, a lot of your experience is on the go-to-market side and helping companies accelerate and so on. But also, we know that you've, in lack of better terms, you've become a pricing nerd.
Yes.
Like, how did that come about, and what does that mean?
Well, honestly, probably by accident is how it came about. This was December 2015. I was working at BlaBlaCar at the time. So BlaBlaCar is one of the more well-known French successful scale-ups for those people in the Nordics who don't know it.
Despite the name.
Despite the name, correct. my manager came to me and was like, guess what? You're responsible for pricing. Go figure it out.
Okay.
Which is that's a pretty typical like way that startups work. You get a mandate, you give it to somebody who doesn't know it before, and you just go figure it out. That's what's so beautiful about getting to work in startups. One of the reasons I think many of us listening to this podcast, that's why we're drawn to it. At the time in 2015, there wasn't very much literature on pricing, sort of how you should do it. Like, sure, you should have a pricing page with three tiers, but there wasn't much more. And so I got the ability to really learn about it from a first principles perspective. And at BlaBlaCar, that's a C2C marketplace. So actually, it's not specifically like the same tactics you would use in SaaS. But having gone back down to the basics, to really understand, how do you figure out a customer's willingness to pay? What does convenience mean? What does that mean in value? Is something that I've sort of carried with me in sort of how I look at companies, how I work in companies. And that's really where I just see that pricing is one of the most underused levers in SaaS. And so there's a reason I talk about it a lot, because I think it's something that I really want founders to not forget about, so to speak.
Yeah, and we're excited to have you in the pricing panel at SaaSiest here in just a week's time. So don't miss it. But if we go to Aux,
yes.
What kind of investor are you?
We are a specialist investor. We only invest in B2B software companies, and we're very happy that we only ever have invested in that and only ever will invest in software companies. Specifically within that, though, we invest in companies at what we would say is the emerging go-to-market fit phase. So product market fit is already clearly established, and companies have started getting onto that journey of understanding really how they acquire, retain, and upsell customers, and are able to do so in a sustainable way.
All right. Do you have to be on a particular ARR or?
No. Companies can definitely reach go-to-market fit at different phases. We tend to see that it's most common in the sort of, shall we say, single digits before 10 million ARR. After 10, most companies that make it that far have figured it out. And if you're too small, then it's just usually you haven't had enough time to do the go-to-market experimentation that you need to do in order to learn what is the best way to approach your go-to-market.
Yeah. And do you have a preference what the cap table looks like? Should it be, you know, a bootstrapped company or when it comes to the current owners, what are you looking at there?
I said the most typical investment for us definitely has already had some institutional venture capital funding rounds before we would invest. With that said, we have also invested in one or two bootstrap companies in our first fund. So most typically, you've already taken in some capital, you are scaling your company, and you have sort of that venture journey ahead of you. But that's not always the case. So again, what we're looking at is more the mindset of, are you scaling your go-to-market motion in a sustainable way?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And are there any particular verticals, if you may, that you say like, okay, here's our sweet spot. We do a particular type of businesses that we are a little bit extra in favor. And are there certain geos that are more, call it, you know, popular or heavily represented in your portfolio companies?
So I'll take the second one first and then the first one. So from a geographic perspective, we are a Stockholm and London based investment firm. So from the Nordic perspective, we're both a local investor and an international investor, which is quite fun, really, because we can often bring in that international perspective when we speak with Swedish or Nordic founders. We can invest across Europe and Israel, but because of where we sit, we have more investments in the Nordics and the UK. What was your first question?
I mean, B2B SaaS is wide.
It's wide. Yeah.
You might think it's a narrow field, but for us, it's the world, right? So is there any particular verticals within the B2B SaaS universe that you focus on?
There are none we definitely exclude. So we're relatively industry agnostic. We tend to prefer verticals that are allow you to build companies with a bit of product depth.
Okay.
So we're going to be less attracted to sectors with a lot of competition where you might only build for your local market. We're really looking for companies that have a sort of unique product angle that can take them to a global category leader.
Gotcha. Makes a lot of sense. And you mentioned that, you know, you had a first fund and now you have multiple funds. Now, congratulations, by the way. You just recently closed the last fund here.
How much money do you have?
Yeah, exactly. How much money do you have to allocate to the great founders that are listening to this episode? Now they're like, you know, sitting sharply in their chairs listening.
It's all about the money.
It's all about the money.
Kishing.
So exactly. How much money do you have to allocate here over the next, let's say, you know, 2-3 years?
Yeah. The second fund generation is $190 million. So we're currently now still looking for about seven to eight investments over the next 2 years that we want to find. So that's plenty of new companies that we really want to back. And I personally would love to find more in the Nordic countries.
All right. Cool. We've already touched that you preferably work with companies that have reached product market fit. And you know what we're going to talk about today is, okay, you did that. What's next? So what would you say, just before we go on, if people are not familiar with the term product market fit, what is it really?
Sure. I mean, product market fit is, there is a lot of literature on it online. So it is something that you are able to sort of read yourself to. But from the metrics perspective, what most investors define it at is that you can see that the retention metrics are starting to settle in and starting to be healthy. So you have good gross retention, low churn, and you have high net revenue retention. What's a little difficult by measuring with net revenue retention, though, is that not all companies with product market fit have actually built out the pricing model that allows them to upsell. So just because you have low rent, like not high net revenue retention doesn't mean you don't have product market fit. The more qualitative way to think about it is usually that, have you built a product that customers love and can you sell that product? So that you can measure on qualitative customer feedback. You can measure it on the sense of sort of how business critical is the product that you now have sold to your customers? Do they use it on a daily basis? And can customers really speak to the pain point that they've been able to solve with it and therefore the ROI that they're getting from it?
Yeah.
You'll be able to measure that easier sort of over time, but that's the qualitative picture of what you're looking for in product market fit.
And maybe also a product that is standardized in the way that you don't have to tweak it for every customer.
For sure.
Perhaps, or do you look at that as well? Yeah.
So the very definition of a SaaS product, right, is that it's scalable. So you should be able to deliver the same product to a new customer without having to build new features, for sure.
Yeah.
I would say that if you're in the super enterprise segment, it's okay if you have to do some configuration for new customers,
Yeah. But
not customization.
Right.
So that's the sort of differentiating line. Is it configuration or customization?
Yeah. I mean, and then I have to ask you, because I'm curious here, reaching or establishing product market fit, that's good.
Yeah.
You know, congratulations to everyone that has managed to get to that.
Pop a bottle of champagne, sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Or wine.
Or wine from California, whatever is your choice of poison. So congratulations when you achieve that. And then we talked a little bit like, you know, from that point and then transitioning into, call it the scale-up phase.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's a mismatch of what these companies start to measure and mm-hmm. how they interpret those types of KPIs and how they act on that. Can you develop that a little bit?
Yeah. I think that in a way it sort of comes back to this, again, I suppose it's what we're talking about all the time at Ox, is that building a sustainable go-to-market is not the same as saying, I've reached product market fit, let's just hire a really big go-to-market team and scale internationally all at once. It's sort of, you have to crawl and walk before you can run. And it's sort of that walking phase that startups sometimes try to take shortcuts during.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I can sort of see that also investors ourselves sometimes incorrectly push companies to do that. Because when you're fundraising, you're asked about, okay, what's your CAC payback period? What's your LTV over CAC? What's your net revenue retention? These are all pretty high-level metrics and there's a certain benchmark that people want you to hit. But if you only try to scale to those benchmarks right away, you're kind of forgetting about the phase where, wait, okay, so I'm a 20-person company now. I've reached product market fit. I probably have like what, maybe max 5 people on my go-to-market teams. Like maybe haven't even hired in a VP of marketing. And so there's a lot of more basic things to do before you really want to start measuring your entire go-to-market team after these high-level metrics. And the way I think about it is there's sort of, when I came into Volumental, my previous company before Ox in 2018, we were a 3-person go-to-market team. We had about 5 customers. We did have product market fit with those, but it would have been silly to try to measure an LTV over CAC for the company. Mm. What we more needed, I mean, come on, it's kind of, yeah. What are you going to learn from that? Oh, it's 4. You should make it 6.
Yeah.
You have 6 months to do that. Like, that's not a direction you can give anybody. That's not helpful. And so what would be helpful for investors to do more is to help companies during that particular phase to say, slow down, it's okay. Here are sort of the in-between things that you might want to think about. There's a pretty big layer of nuance in between that. There's other sorts of leading indicator metrics that can help you get there.
So which are those metrics? Which are those metrics that one should, you know, the in-between KPIs we should track instead?
Price.
Okay.
Haha. No, there's more than that. Yeah.
Tell us.
Well, no, but actually I will start with price. And then I think there's probably like a handful basically, but price is absolutely one, because one of the most classic things that happens to many SaaS companies is that you sort of have gotten to product market fit. And then you start being, if you have a great product, you start being pulled up market. Mm-hmm. So you start getting customers that are slightly larger companies, they want to buy from you. And so you can increase your deal sizes, which means that your average sale price increases and your average revenue per account increases. That actually is what often allows you to build out a go-to-market team and still keep good unit economics. So having an eye to how price maybe will evolve is actually really important, especially in those sort of the sale price, because it's going to affect your average price. The other things I often think about is sales cycle lengths, sales conversion rates, and sort of how much of your ICP you have in your funnel. Mm. Those 3 things are sort of things that you can very actively influence if you are the sales or marketing team leaders, and they will have an impact eventually on those later stage metrics of the CAC payback period, for example. The shorter the sales cycle length, well, you have multiple benefits if you have a shorter sales cycle length, right? If you're able to close deals faster, that means that each individual person can probably work on more deals because you need fewer meetings to be able to close one. So pretty mechanically, should take less time. The sort of second order benefit to a shorter sales cycle length is that you can actually get feedback from your market much faster in your go-to-market experiments. So it's often the one thing I recommend that, like, it's worth it to try to measure that as quickly as possible and to think about what are the ways that we could shorten that. Maybe we have good intuitions on which customers are just not going to close. Okay, well, we should deprioritize them. We should focus on the ones that we think we have the highest probability to close. So those are the sorts of things that you can actually start measuring and making decisions around, even when you have fewer reps, before you're actually working with a CFO to say like, okay, I need 2 more heads here, la, 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 la. That's sort of a bit later stage. This is sort of the starting phases of building to that place.
Yeah.
The percentage ICP in your funnel, to me, is it, that's sort of something that's a good thing for a marketing team to try to work towards, is to think about, okay, I've delivered you 100 leads, but how many of the leads are actually the ones we really, really want?
Yeah.
And how can I think not only about scaling volume, 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 but scaling, I got the perfect ones for the sales team themselves.
Yeah.
So those are just sort of examples. If you hit those and you hit them really well, the rest is going to follow.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. You triggered a few thoughts in my head here now. And
okay.
It's early morning here, so bear with me.
So only a few thoughts, not a lot of thoughts.
A lot of thoughts. I'm going to stick to a few of them, though.
Okay.
I 100% agree with you that these in-between metrics, and we've seen way too many companies, you know, that are early stage that try to benchmark themselves with somebody that is much later and much, you know, in terms of ARR, further along and so on. And then there's a mismatch, you know, when it comes to measuring these KPIs, you seemingly underperform on all of these things. So I really appreciate about these in-between indicators that you're talking about. But one thing that was triggered with me here is that you mentioned in the beginning that some investors are pushing some of these high-level KPIs maybe down to these guys too early. Does that mean that, you know, those investors don't know what they're doing, or like there's simply a mismatch? You should avoid those, because then if you end up in the hands of an investor like that, I'm not saying that you should talk bad about an investor, but it sounds to me like if you end up in the hands of an owner that sets goals for you that are difficult to meet right here, right now, that sounds like a very tricky equation.
It is a tricky equation for sure. And I think that that's, it's one of the things that the reality is that if you're an investor, especially if you're a generalist investor, so you invest in all different business models, then you don't have as much time often to spend on an individual potential investment. And so you have to, the way that the investment firm tries to make their processes more efficient is to set sort of black and white benchmarks. Does this potential investment meet this or not meet this? If it doesn't, we're just going to say no. It's okay if we say no.
Right.
That then obviously pushes and incentivizes a potential company that is seeking an investment to try to land on the right side of those sort of black and white lines.
Yeah.
Again, that doesn't necessarily make them bad investors.
Absolutely.
It's just that they are trying to optimize to get the best investments in a different way than perhaps a firm like Oxwood, where because we're a specialist in only SaaS, we'll often go sort of one level deeper and ask a bit about those sort of in-between metrics.
Right.
And think about what might that mean for the future metrics in sort of a year or two.
Mm, right.
So it's just a difference in sort of focus and how you think about it.
Yeah.
Is more what I would say. But with that said, then when you are, what then incentivizes the sort of investors, say that you're the seed stage investor, of course, you have to push your company to try to hit a metric to get on the right side of that black and white line.
Right, of course.
So it's sort of a system pushing companies to do a certain thing.
Yeah.
Rather than people being bad at what they do.
Yeah, I 100% again, I agree with you. And if there's any conclusion that I would draw from this is, again, to remind, you know, founders, CEOs there that it's like a marriage. Like, there's a bunch of great potential partners out there. There's nothing wrong with anyone, but there might be some that are a better fit for you. So it's a two-way exercise. You need to find somebody that can support you and can understand the challenges you have ahead of you right here, right now, and help you walk through that. And you shouldn't just jump on the first one because he or she is representing a big brand or is, you know, flashing a big check in front of you. Because if you don't have alignment in some of these in-between metrics and what needs to happen here next and how you define success, that big check might not help you. So I think it's a two-way exercise. Like, you still need to, you know, be mindful of who you bring on board to tag along throughout this journey. All right. With that being said, now, product market fit is there. We have a set of indicators, in between indicators here that we might be tracking and so on. Now, tell us a little bit about how you look at the transformation of the teams, you know, going from one phase here into the next phase.
Yeah, for sure. So the classic mistake that, well, actually, there's a few classic mistakes that people make when they sort of start scaling out their go-to-market teams. I'm sort of taking this assumption that we're talking about this hypothetical company, you're like 15 to 25 people, you probably have about 5 people total in go-to-market. So maybe 1 or 2 marketers, 2 or 3 salespeople. That's sort of where we're starting from, so to speak. And so on the sort of hiring in your leader's side, the classic mistake that most people make is that they sometimes try to hire someone who's too senior for the stage that they're at, who isn't also willing to roll up their sleeves. Because in that sort of first expansion, you still need leaders who are also going to be willing to do. It's not just about managing managers yet. You haven't proven the right to get there. The second mistake that I see that companies sometimes make is that you hire account executives that are still a little bit too junior. Remember that we said that you're probably going to see that you're being pulled into these higher ACV deals by bigger companies. Okay, cool. That's great. It is a skill set to sell to a big company. It is not as easy as selling to a small company. And then the third one, I think, and in some ways that's something I experienced myself, is you can't forget about the sort of, shall we call them the glue roles in between. It's not only about AEs, SDRs, and demand generation marketers. There's other supporting roles that sort of make the team a whole. Yes, when you have a sort of maybe 10 to 15 person go-to-market team, you still don't have a lot of those people. So you have to pick them super carefully. But it's sometimes the one that's more difficult to motivate to the CEO and CFO because they don't carry a quota if they're in the sales team, or they're not directly generating leads if they're in the marketing team.
So what's a typical glue role?
Yeah, so product marketing is my typical one on the marketing side.
Okay.
On the sales side, it might be sort of sales ops.
All right.
Right? So product marketing, why should you hire a product marketer earlier? Because I said so, might not be enough for the listeners on this podcast.
Done. That's it.
Yeah, done. We're good. We can finish up the podcast.
Google it. Come on.
No, but like, look, product marketing, it's not going to generate you more leads next quarter. So it seems like maybe it's a stupid short-term investment, but it's such a helpful long-term investment. So the way I remember trying to justify that this was a good thing to put into my budget, this was back in 2019, was to say that, but if the person does a good job, the sales cycles will be shorter and the conversion rates will be higher. Therefore, it's going to indirectly impact our CAC payback period, even if that person is not directly generating leads.
Should product marketing have a higher status, do you think?
I mean, in my world, it doesn't have a low status. So
it's just like, bam, we just insulted all product marketers.
No. But it might be a role that not everyone understands exactly, you know, what are their function, what are their mandate, and where in the organization they belong. And it's very different, sometimes in marketing, sometimes in product.
For sure.
And
I mean, I can agree with you that there are definitely cohorts of people who think that product marketing, all they do is to create slides and they might as well work in consulting firms, which is... I didn't say that, but I have heard it said. I think that what... you can kind of think of the need for product marketing increases as your product becomes more complex and your go-to-market becomes more complex. Because, again, if you're a team of 20 people and there's like two salespeople and then there's a bunch of engineers, guess what? Everybody knows about the deals coming through the pipeline. Like literally everyone knows that because you're all like basically in a... you're not in a one garage, but it's like a small office. People know what are the exciting deals. And if you need something to perhaps impress this potential lead and you have a presentation next week, you can ask maybe a product person to hop in on the demo call and to explain an upcoming feature.
Mm.
The team's quite small.
Right.
Yes. What happens when you're 35 people or 40 people? Suddenly you have five salespeople. How are five salespeople all going to keep track of what is the stuff coming down the product pipeline?
Yeah.
How are the engineering teams going to know about all the deals in the sales pipeline? They're not. And so suddenly you have to scale what is the knowledge of what's going to come between product and marketing.
Yeah.
And that's why I call it a glue function, actually, because it connects the information of those things together.
Absolutely. And I know at SaaSiest next week, Johanna Fagerstedt at Mentimeter is going to talk about sparketing. And it sounds like a lot of glue there or something. Somewhere.
Ooh, that sounds super exciting. I am definitely going to try to attend that session.
Yeah. And another thing you mentioned a little bit, you know, when you start scaling the team, should you focus on sales or marketing first?
Oof. If you have the luxury, I would try to get the marketing and the sales leader to start around the same time.
Okay.
I think that's one of the best ways to avoid marketing and sales misalignment, because then it's two people actually building a unified strategy together.
Okay.
That's one of the things I think we got really right at Volumental when we scaled that function.
Okay.
I worked for 20 years ago, probably now, almost, for a German CEO, German startup.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we probably were like 20, 25 people when he said this in a company meeting. He's like, I don't care what your role is. I don't care what your title is. You work in sales. Everything you do should either directly generate revenue or should indirectly support a revenue generation exercise. If you can't tie your activities to this, then it's probably not a priority activity. Now, he exaggerated a little bit, but it was just to show that when we're this small, we can't maybe do some stuff that bigger companies do that we can't, you know, tie back to money and revenue, because this is where we are right now. And I like, that's lived with me forever. I don't know if you agree with that statement, but it was super clear. Like, he was like, I don't care if you're in finance, like, whatever you do is like, if you can find a way to work on how we can improve, you know, invoice to collected cash, well, then that's a priority than building some other stuff in the finance function.
I actually do agree with that. And I think that from that analogy, we were just talking about product marketing and that idea of like, when you scale, you need to have more communications infrastructure. But yeah, when you're 15 people, everyone does work in sales.
Right.
Everyone really cares about getting that next customer. Yeah. And there's that magical, feeling that everyone is in the boat and rowing the same direction together. That's one of the sort of attractions of those really working in a really early stage startup. And then when you start to scale, how do you maintain that is one of the most challenging things possible. But you can't sort of like let up on that too quickly. You can't hire to the point you should. I think that you should try to hire scale sales and marketing pretty simultaneously.
Right.
But you should definitely hire marketers at that early phase who know that their primary objective is to influence revenue. Whether that is on a very short-term or long-term basis, that's sort of where you can have the discussion. But it should definitely be influencing revenue. And if it doesn't, and if you don't have a hypothesis of how this initiative that you're going to champion next quarter is going to do that, then you should question whether you do need to do that. So that's where, I don't know, resetting your messaging or rethinking about tweaking your ICP. Okay, this might not bring leads next quarter, but if you do figure out how a better definition of your ICP, it will eventually influence the share of ICP that you get into your funnel through the marketing activities that you then do. So by sort of linking that activity still to how that is going to influence revenue, that does keep everybody aligned.
Yeah.
And that's probably still, in a way, it's the North Star metric. Like, it's funny because a lot of companies, right? Like, what's your North Star metric? It's usually tied to product usage, which is great because that is usually how product then ends up going from like the number of people using my product on a daily basis that are North Star metric, and therefore that will scale to revenue. In some ways, the marketing teams don't go through that sort of product North Star metric, but they still need to think about how does whatever I do tie back to revenue at some point.
Okay. Anything new?
Yeah, I've been thinking. Do you know what capital as a service is?
Isn't that what Float offers?
Yes, it is. Think of it as CaaS for SaaS. You already understand how software works. It's easy, simple, and flexible. Just like most SaaS companies focus on user experience, Float brings the same digital experience in funding, where clients can customize their loans. It sounds impossible, right?
Yes! We are really entering a new era in funding. It sounds too good to be true. I also heard that even the loan contract can be read by a normal human. It doesn't require any guarantees or warrants. So exciting! I have to check it out on their website if this is for real at gofloat.io.
So I wanted to also ask you then, one thing we sometimes observe, and I think it just, you know, nature having its course here. When people do raise their first significant round, then we tend to see that they're a little bit more in favor of experiments. Suddenly there's a bunch of programs that they're betting on. And I don't want to say that they lose track of what used to work, but there's sometimes a tendency that, you know, they spread themselves a little bit too thin and do a bunch of stuff. So are there certain commercial bets that you feel that these seem to work more often than others? So focus on these things as your first investments.
I think it's a pretty hard one to generalize on, because obviously if you have like a product-led growth motion and you've raised a funding round, is pretty different than if you have a sales enterprise motion. So with that caveat, I'll sort of go through some of the things that come to mind. But that's just to say, it's not that I don't love all go-to-market motions, but not all things are good for all go-to-market motions. Let's put it that way.
Gotcha. Yeah. So now that we have the insurance in place.
Blanket insurance. But the thing is, I am still giving advice, like, do try this at home. It's not about don't try this at home. So I think that sort of Well, let's talk meta then instead. Just don't do too many experiments at once, I think is absolutely something that is worthwhile. Try to do experiments that have, don't take 2 years to prove out either. You want to try the things that you can figure out whether they're true or false in about 3 to 6 months. The third thing would be to don't be afraid to make that minimum investment you do need to do to validate it, but just try to just figure out how quickly can you decide whether it's working or not. Those were all sort of pretty abstract. What does that mean?
Yeah.
But let's take sort of international expansion as the example then. Don't try to take on 4 new international markets at once. 4 is a lot. 4 means that you have to suddenly build 4 different playbooks. So everybody has to build 4 playbooks in marketing, 4 playbooks in sales. You have to hire 4 more times of people. It's just a lot more work.
Right.
If you do 2, that's easier. Like 1, yeah, how do you know if it works or doesn't work? 2, you can compare and contrast. It's very nice. 2 is much easier. So do 2. And then think about, do you think that in your product category, having a local office is something that is absolutely necessary in order to be able to prove out that that internationalization works or doesn't work? If it is absolutely necessary, then yeah, maybe that's a cost you're going to need to bear to prove out that hypothesis. If it's not necessary, do you think that you might get enough sort of, I don't know, initial customers from, you could hire, like, there's so many international people in tech in Stockholm. Do you think that you might be able to find an international person in Stockholm that could help you expand to the first few customers there and prove out that market ahead of time? That's a lower cost way to get to the same answer.
Gotcha.
That's sort of the international expansion one. We can go into other examples if we want. But that's sort of like what I've seen work and doesn't work. There's also some companies that manage to sell internationally without ever really setting up offices there. So you can challenge the conventional norms, but you should know why you're doing it.
Mm. Gotcha.
All right. So we have talked a little bit, you know, about this in-between phase.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you know when you have come past that?
That's actually a pretty good question.
Yes.
Are you saying all other questions were not pretty good? I'm just kidding with you, Ingrid.
No, it's the classic stalling tactic of, I wasn't expecting that question. Now I have to actually think about my answer.
You know, we actually learned about that tactic, or we were at least reminded, because a lot of guests in the beginning, they were like, that is a great question. That is an interesting question. We're like, wow. Like,
you thought you were really smart.
Yeah, it's like, are we really good at interviewing? Or it's like, and then we realized, like, oh no, people need to buy themselves some time here.
So I'm going to give you a qualitative answer, actually, which is that I think at this point, you've hired a CFO, and you as the CEO, you're not getting complaints from the CFO that you don't get sufficiently good inputs from your marketing and sales leaders to help you build out a pretty accurate forecast model with good assumptions and good ways of tweaking it.
Nice. That's very specific.
I think it's quite true though, right?
Right.
Which means that if you have already measured all of these like in-between metrics, these can plug into this financial model that your CFO does, and you will get something out. And then if you want to tweak it or have different cash in, then and you can get a new model in a relatively short amount of time. And that's because the sales and marketing leaders really understand those in-between metrics and therefore the inputs into that. So that's actually how I would try to measure it in a roundabout way. If your sales and marketing teams don't know those inputs, then it's going to be much harder for the finance team to do that modeling. And also the model is much likelier to be have a wrong output. So you're going to miss your forecast in one direction or another.
Okay. So once upon a time when we took our early steps here building the Sassiest community, we did a number of Clubhouse events, if you remember Clubhouse. One theme of that was, why the heck do you need a CFO? And the question here is, you know, when do you need the CFO?
It's a good question too. See, also thinking and stalling. Yeah. No. There's a difference between a finance director and a VP of finance and a CFO for sure. So I think that that's somewhere where companies sometimes get it a little bit wrong too. Your finance director / VP of finance, you probably actually want in earlier than you think, because that's really about building that first financial model, not like getting some of the basics things in place correctly. especially as you start to scale to more, again, coming back to that analogy of you're getting larger deal sizes, larger companies, they're paying you annually up front. You suddenly have more things happening in your balance sheet than when you were a teeny tiny little company. You were just thinking about cash coming in and out. That you're going to want sooner than you think. So definitely like sort of if you don't already have in place by your Series A, very soon thereafter. CFO, that sort of strategic business partner, that can usually come a little bit later. So that might be a role then that sort of levels up as you're rather nearing the sort of later stage Series B phase around 10 million ARR.
Okay.
Okay. We are still in the phase, Thomas, where it's cash in, cash out. So that's where we are. It's like, so if you're a CFO looking for a job, as much as we'd love you, we're not the right employer for you yet.
No. Yet. How big is the Sassiest CFO community?
Oh, the CFO community. That's a great question.
Yeah. But there is two groups. So we have, you know, the community is big, but we have our executive network that is VPs and C-level people. And you need to be on a certain size. So that your company needs to be 2 million Euro ARR and up. But we have two groups and maybe around 30 members, something like that, Daniel. It's your group. You moderate that.
Yeah. So there's around, I think there's a nuanced way to answer this. We probably interact with a few hundred CFOs on a monthly basis across our channels, where it's like, you know, one-way communication and sometimes one and a half or two-way. Mm-hmm. Where we interact monthly in a three-way communication, meaning us and the CFOs, CFOs to us, and CFOs with each other, that happens on a monthly basis. And in that network group, there's about 30 of them or something like that, like Thomas said,
yeah,
that are all above 2 million euros in ARR and upwards. And it's fantastic. It's a really impressive set of people. And also, it's great for us to understand, you know, what's top of mind for them and see how we can support that community.
And it's growing a lot. I think it's growing 50% this year and a lot of interest.
Very cool.
Yeah. Cool. So we talked a lot about, you know, the product market fit, the in-between phase and so on. Mm-hmm. Tell us then, again, you now hopefully have go-to-market fit as well. Mm-hmm. How would you define that?
Yeah. So I define it in the sense that you know exactly how you acquire, retain, and upsell your customers. You're doing it at good unit economics, and you understand if you shift A, B is likely to happen. So if you hire this person, that is likely to affect upsell in this way. If you adjust another pricing lever, that is likely to happen to your unit economics. So your feedback loop of action, sort of reaction, has become predictable.
All right, cool. So, I mean, this has been great. I think we have got a lot of insights and just, you know, getting a structure and understand, you know, this in-between phase. But just to summarize it a little bit, you reached product market fit. What next, if you would take it just in a few bullets?
Yeah, so it's just don't skip ahead to go. Actually go around the monopoly board. And when you're going around the monopoly board, think about what are the metrics that are more helpful to give to your sort of the recently hired VP of marketing or VP of sales that you have, as those are the metrics to focus their team on improving in order that you then will get the benefits of good and predictable unit economics. We talked about sales cycle lengths. We talked about sale prices. We talked about conversion rates, ICP and funnel. And then we talked a bit about if you do get those right, the sort of rest of the metrics will follow. And make sure then that as you hire, you're thinking about the expansions in those terms. How do those people impact those metrics? And that's how you want to be able to evaluate them as well.
Great summary. Thank you so much for that.
All right. So to end off a little bit, what's in the future for Ox here the next coming year? So you said you had some money to spend, 7-8 different investments. Any Any dreams? Any dream investments?
That would be like picking favorites. Yeah. Right? I probably, the thing is, I don't know what my dream investment is going to be that I find in 6 months. So it's this, listeners to the podcast, you guys are going to tell me. That's what's exciting.
Yeah. So what is the best way of sort of, if I have this great company and, you know, listen to the podcast or I've read about you before, how is the best way of getting in touch with you?
Messaging me on LinkedIn is probably the quickest and easiest way. Otherwise, sending me an email.
All right.
It's initials@ox.vc for all of us. So
cool. How easy is it to get in front of you and pitch your company?
It's definitely easier if you're actually a SaaS company than if you're not a SaaS company. You'd be surprised at the number of people that email us who are not SaaS companies, despite that being like the very first thing that says on the website, which just makes you feel like as a sort of ex-marketer that like, make this beautiful website. Do people read it?
So on this continued journey of yours, like, you know, I know you have a great team over there. Is there anything else you're looking here or like... Can the community help you somehow, besides obviously sending you fantastic companies your way? Is there any way the community can help you?
I think that the best way that the community can help usually is by like getting in touch with really exciting other companies is a great way to do so. I think that one way, though, that the community helps us indirectly is very much through... Often what happens is that you'd be surprised at how often somebody has a question, right, from one of our portfolio companies. They're like, Ingrid, what's the right amount, what's the right percentage of AWS spent to your revenue? And I'm like, oh, whoa, I don't know that specifically, but I can make some calls and try to figure that out.
Yeah.
And so I think just this, the sense of like taking what you know and being very open to share that as advice for how other people improve their companies will improve Ox's portfolio companies as it will other SaaS companies as well.
Yeah,
definitely. We live by that. Democratizing B2B SaaS knowledge. It says in our first vision deck.
It's been great having you on the show, Ingrid. Is there anyone that you think we should invite or any particular topic that you think we should deep dive into?
Would love to get a sense of how sort of recruiting, like the sort of talk about product marketing made me think about this, but would love to get a sense of sort of how recruiting is happening in the Nordic markets, which positions are easier to find, harder to find, the trends of happening in 2023, 2024. I worked with a good SaaS recruiter, Lina Vik, here in Sweden a bit.
Yeah.
Love to hear what she has to say about it.
We know her, Lina. If you're listening, shout out to you. See you at Sassiest.
There you go. So Sassiest is a good place to get all of this back and forth advice. But yeah, I would love to learn more about recruiting, how that is, what's sort of up with that in the Nordics right now.
All right. Cool.
And otherwise, we're going to learn so much from different people at Sassiest too, that we're going to have our sort of minds full of lots of new information.
Exactly. Our minds will be expanded here in a week's time, and our minds were also expanded here today. Ingrid, thank you so much for so generously sharing your time with us and sharing your experience that you've gained here throughout the years. Thank you so much. We'll see you in whatever it is, a week's time.
Yeah.
About a week's time, actually. It's sort of scarily close. How are you guys feeling? Are you ready?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Now, the people can't see our faces. Like, we're saying one thing, but like we're a little bit exhausted and pale.
No, but it feels great.
To everybody listening, there was actually a sort of a note of shock and fear that ran across their faces even as they said yes.
No, but I think, you know, it's a little bit, when you're a week ahead, it feels a little bit surreal that it's going to happen in a week. You can't really take it in. But then when you stand there and you see the whole exhibition is built and all the decorations and all the people there starting arriving, you get that adrenaline kick that is amazing. And then, you know, you're just in it for a few days. But right now it's still a little bit, you know.
I'll give you a perfect example. Like, so for months we've been working on the big elements, you know, making sure that we have the right partners with us, making sure that the setup is right for the partners, making sure that we have the right program, that the speakers are set up. If you have that, then you have attendees, making sure that the attendees know what they can expect, you know, how to plan their days and all of these things. So there's some critical elements that are really big that take months to think about and prepare and set up. But sometimes you enter the phase where it's the nitty-gritty details that you can potentially ignore, but in our world, it's just icing on the cake a little bit and makes it special. So yesterday, we were like, oh no, where's the sweatbands for the paddle? The fantastic pink sweatbands that everybody needs to wear during the paddle. Oh, we forgot to order that. So it's small things like this. So yesterday we placed an order. Like we probably overpaid for those damn sweatbands. But it's the small details that create this vibe that we want to have. You know, the speakers are there. The partners are there. The attendees are there. That's going to be great.
Yeah. Can we make the venue create that drink that we want to have on the drink menu and those kind of small things that are important?
They definitely matter.
They matter.
That's what makes one event memorable from another.
Definitely. So now you know. If you're playing paddle, you're going to get a sweatband.
Okay.
And it's going to be pink and you're going to be looking fly when you play there. And
so you found it yesterday.
I ordered it from another country. Like I didn't tell you, but we definitely overpaid.
Super. Glad to hear.
All right.
But with that, Ingrid, pleasure to have you. See you soon. And looking forward for you reviewing the wine at Sassiest.
I am looking forward to that as well.
All right. Take care now.
All right. See you guys soon.
Bye.
Bye.
So Daniel, what's your main takeaway from the episode today?
Great session. Always lovely chatting with Ingrid, married to a French man. I was surprised to say that her favorite wine was from California. So that's one thing that surprised me.
Was that your big takeaway?
That's one of the things I take with me here. Californians make fantastic wine.
Okay.
Now, all jokes aside.
Yeah.
I think she said many, many great things here. Lots of good tips, lots of experience that she could share here that, you know, we can all relate to. One thing I want to highlight here is, and also that we've seen, is when she talked about don't underestimate the glue roles.
I knew it. You were going to take that.
You knew, huh?
Pretty obvious.
Am I that open book? Am I that much of an open book here?
We know each other too well.
Yeah, so the glue roles, and we've seen that in the past. You know, people invest often too late in, you know, sales op, revenue ops, whatever you want to call it, in product marketing. They come in probably a little bit too late, and you need to find a way to motivate that investment and to make room for that investment maybe a little bit earlier than what you considered, because that's going to pay off in the long run. So too many investments are maybe done with a short-sighted goal, but you got it there and find room to make some of these investments that's going to pay out long-term. So yeah, that's my big takeaway. How about you, Thomas?
All right, so I'll go on the recruiting side. So when you're in this in-between state, it's really important that you get the right people on board. And we talked about the go-to-market roles, we talked about sales, and you know, it's easy to fall in the trap to hire that Salesforce big salesperson that might not be ready to roll up the sleeves and do the work that needs to be done. But it's equally important not to hire two junior sales roles and maybe be too dependent on the founders doing the sales, because at some point you need to create a strong sales team. You need to find a VP of sales that can set a good structure, that create an organization that can scale, can focus on building that sales team, but also can be operative and active when it's needed to be. So, that's mine.
Good takeaway. And now Ingrid is obviously not here. She's left the recording. She probably would like us to say something about the leading indicator she was talking about, which I also think is worth mentioning here and important to highlight that. There are some standard KPIs that apply to all of us, but we might not be able to hit them early on, or at least not hit the benchmark early on in our SaaS journeys. So the in-betweeners here and the leading indicators, I like how she talked about, you know, pricing as an indicator, sales velocity or sales cycle length. It's important to measure these types of things to see that you're progressing, you're making advancements here. So identify which one those are for you and make sure you track them. And if they're moving in the right direction, then everything else, hopefully, is going to fall into place down the road.
Yeah. So with that, thank you for listening today. We appreciate that you take your time to learn more together with us. And hope to see you next week at Sassiest, and that we get some time to chit chat. And otherwise, take care and see you around.
See you.